Man, that looks like a pretty podium. Might be able to do something with it. I can hide behind it.
You want to sit or stand?
I definitely want to sit. Hello, everyone. How are you? You are doing better than me. Thank you, Riley. I was hoping to get that swivel stool so I can make noise while I'm up here. Eager, eager. No, I'm good. Yes, just thump me in the ear if I say something wrong. All right. Cool. So, I'm Blake Roseman. For those of you who know me, I've already apologized. For those of you who don't, I apologize in advance. Just playing. Jody taught us last week on chapter 12, and it ended in how all of Israel came together with a single mind to make David king. And tonight we're going to be reading chapter 13 and 14. We should be out of here by 11 o'clock and we can go home and sleep then. But in chapter 13, this is right on the backside of them having a joyous celebration, a feast. They got together and had a big party and anointed David king. And then right after that, in 13, it says that David consulted with the commanders of the thousands and of the hundreds, with every leader. And David said to all the assembly of Israel, "If it seems good to you, and from our Lord, and from the Lord our God, let us send abroad to our brothers who remain in all the lands of Israel, as well as to the priests and the Levites in the cities that have pasture lands, that they may be gathered to us. Then let us bring again the ark of our God to us, for we did not seek it in the days of Saul." And all the assembly agreed to do so, for the thing was right in the eyes of all the people. So David calls and sends out a message to all of Israel, and even to the Levites who were in the pasture lands. That's like all the way to Tueg, you know, and he's calling everybody in to have a celebration. And I love that about David's heart. You know, he becomes king and, you know, his first instinct is, let's have communion. Let's draw everybody into this thing. Let's enjoy this together. You know, any other tyrant would immediately squash his enemies, get rid of any dissent. But David's not a tyrant. I mean, he's a man after God's own heart. And so I really like that about David. I love that because of his heart, he desires to kind of be equal with everybody else. Even though he's the leader, he still desires to be on an equal playing ground with everybody else. And then the second thing that comes to mind as soon as he's king is, let's go and get the ark. We never saw it in the days of Saul, and so let's go and get it now. And it seemed right in the eyes of the people. Now, a little backstory. The reason why they don't have the ark is the last time that the ark was in possession of Israel was whenever it was under Saul's rule. See, Saul had a battle one day with the Philistines, and he wanted to get the Ark of the Covenant and bring it with him. He didn't do anything that God asked him to do. He just lugged the Ark right behind him and thought it would be like a rabbit's foot or a good luck charm for him to win the battle against the Philistines. And it didn't turn out so well. The Philistines ran him right over. I mean, it wasn't even a contest, and they took the Ark. They grabbed it from Saul, so the battle didn't go quite like Saul had planned in his mind. They take it over to Philistia, and they keep it there for 7 months. And the reason why it stayed there for 7 months is at first it went to Ashdod, I believe is the name of the city, and it stayed there for a little while. So they put the ark inside of their temple where Dagon sat. And Dagon was like a fish man statue thing. And so they put the ark in there, and then it says the next morning they rose early and they go in there, and Dagon fell on the ground, man. And so they pick him up, and sorry, somebody texted me like 1,000 times here. I'm in a group message. Yeah, stop that, Riley. So Anyway, the statue fell, and so the next morning they rose early and they went in there. I guess they just went in there every morning early, after they had raised Dagon back up, and he had fallen on the ground again, looking like he was bowing down at the temple, except this time his head and his hands were cut off. So they started realizing, hey, maybe this god of the ark is a little bit more powerful than our god, and they started getting boils. They call them tumors in the Bible, and they started having plagues and all this other stuff happening in the city. So the Philistines are really smart. They said, let's not keep it in this city. Let's send it to another city in Philistia. So they did that, and it went to another city, and the same things were happening. And so they sent it off to another city, and the people of that city said, the people of the other city are trying to kill us because they keep sending this thing to us. So finally they get the message that God didn't want the ark in Philistine possession. So it had been about 7 months. The priests get together, and they say, okay, well, so we got to get rid of this thing, right? So they did kind of like a test and like an impossible task type of thing, because I don't think that the priest wanted to admit that the God of Israel was more powerful than their Dagon God. And so they made golden mice and golden tumors and put it on a new cart. And, you know, the 1002 model, it was a nice one. And they put it on the cart, and they put two cows on there that had just had calves. So they're new moms, and they put them onto this yoke, and they had never been yoked before. These cows had never been yoked. And so by all rights and purposes, the two cows should go in two different directions at the same time and fight each other and just end up going around in an angry circle. But what happened was they started walking straight toward Israel, straight toward Beth Shemesh. And the priests started following. And the reason why they put those gold things into the ark area was so that it could be like a guilt offering to the God of Israel. And so even though these cows were like mooing for their calves, they wanted to go back to their calves. The Philistines put their calves off to the side thinking that the cows would at least follow them. They didn't. The cows were mooing the whole way, but they were walking straight to Beth Shemesh. They couldn't control themselves. God had a plan for the ark, and it was to be back in the land of Israel. So anyway, that's a little bit of the backstory on the ark, and why it wasn't in David's possession in the first place. So he decides to go and get the ark. And so whenever the priests were walked and followed the two cows, the mooing cows with the ark behind them, all the way to Beth Shemesh, and that's an Israeli city. And as soon as it got there, the Philistine priests were like, well, that was fun. I'm all back to go and make some golden, you know, dog poop or something. Whatever else they made golden back in those days, that they just enjoyed making stuff gold. So they walk away, and there was farmers reaping out in the land in Israel. So as they're farming away, I guess they hear these two cows ride, you know, bringing a cart in, and there's no driver on the thing, and I suppose it called for some sort of investigation. They start looking up and realize what's going on, and they see a box on the back of it, and eventually somebody recognizes that it's the Ark of the Covenant. And man, they start rejoicing. It's a party. So they start chopping up the new cart. They throw it into a pile, set it on fire, throw the cows on there as a sacrifice to God. Not a good day for the cows. The cows didn't have a good day. So they do this. The Levites pull off the ark, and they set it down. And then for some reason or another, 70 men look inside of the Ark of the Covenant, and they all die. So, you know, kind of a buzzkill. So what happens is all the men there recognize that the ark, you know, needs to be dealt with properly. So they call over to the city of Kiriath Jearim, or Hiriam. I need to learn Hebrew. So they call over to the city, and they were like, hey, yo, the Phillies just brought the ark back. You guys want it? And so the guys of the city said, yeah, sure, we'll take it over here. So they did, and it ends up in the house of Abinadab. Now, interestingly enough, Abinadab is Saul's son. So Saul was the one that lost the ark, and God brought it right back to the same hands, to the same house of the hands that lost it in the first place. And I thought that pretty interesting. So anyway, it stayed there in Kiriath Jearim. Jerim for about 20 years. And so now we're going to do a flash forward thing to David again. This is about 13 years after that. All right, so seen right now as all the people, and number 5, verse 5. It says, so David assembled all Israel from the Nile of Egypt to Lebo Hamath to bring the ark of God from Kiriath Jearim, and David and all Israel went up to Baalah, that is Kiriath Jearim, that belongs to Judah. All these cities have like 12 different names. To bring up from there the ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord, who sits enthroned above the cherubim. And they carried the ark of God on a new cart from the house of Abinadab, and Uzzah and Ahio were driving the cart. And David and all Israel were rejoicing before God with all their might, with song and lyres and harps and tambourines and cymbals and trumpets. And so we're going to stop there for a second. So, it's a big party, right? He's got a concert, you know, the traveling concert coming along with them. They're celebrating. They got it on an even newer cart. You know, this is the 1002 year model. And it's got all the bells and whistles, you know, the Bose stereo system and the heated and cooled air, seats. I mean, it's got everything, you know. So they put it on a brand new cart and they start traveling with this thing back to Israel. And, so that's that. They're doing that and they're having a great time with it, driving the new cart. And then it says, and when they came to the threshing floor of Kedon, Uzzah put out his hand to take hold of the ark, for the oxen stumbled. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and he struck him down because he put out his hand to the ark, and he died there before God. And David was angry because the Lord had broken out against Uzzah. And that place is called Perez Uzzah to this day. And David was afraid of God that day. And he said, how can I bring the ark of God home to me? So David did not take the ark home into the city of David, but he took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. And the ark of God remained with the household of Obed-Edom in his house 3 months. And the Lord blessed the household of Obed-Edom. Well, the party's over. So, I mean, that's one way to end a party right there. Somebody dying. And, you know, this is kind of one of those verses where you have to sit back and say, where is the loving God that I know, you know, that we've all come to realize who he is? Where's the mercy that's involved with this? And, you know, you just kind of don't see it on the surface. I mean, the guy did the most natural reaction that I think any of us would do. The holy ark of God is stumbling and it's falling. And so he grabs it to stop. I mean, he's stopping the ark from falling on the ground and becoming desecrated. And God kills him, you know. So y'all think about that. Come back next week. Tell me what you think. Now, if we dig a little bit and look into this verse just a touch, I think that we're going to find that God actually exhibited a great amount of mercy and grace through the situation. It says in verse 4 that they did what was right in their eyes. It says the assembly agreed to do so, for the thing was right in the eyes of all the people. They never actually sought the Lord. Whenever David was getting all the people from all of Israel, it says, if it seems good to you and from the Lord our God. But to get the ark, they never prayed about that. They never considered it. They never talked to the Lord. It was just kind of the right thing to do, you know. And I can't be mad at them. I mean, how many times have we done that, you know, in our own lives, where, you know, we just kind of do the right thing and then it falls apart. It turns into dust. I mean, I know that that's happened with me multiple times. But the reason why that this happened is God was meticulously specific about how to handle the ark, how to transport it, how to deal with it in the temple. It was all written out in Numbers chapter 4. And what happens is, the way that they were supposed to handle the ark is whenever they were travel, you know, whenever God gave the original instructions to Moses, whenever they were to travel, they were to take down the tent. And the veil that separated the inner room from the most holy was the veil. You know, the purple and, it was purple and gold veil. I love that. God's an LSU fan. But anyway, they were supposed to fold this thing up and lay it over the cart. I mean, over the Ark of the Covenant. Then they were supposed to take goat skin and lay it on top of that. Then they were supposed to take a blue cloth and lay it over that. So it was supposed to have this, you know, triple protection thing over the Ark of the Covenant. Not only that, it was supposed to be carried by the Levites. And not only that, it was supposed to be carried by poles on their shoulders by the Levites. It wasn't supposed to touch a cart of any kind. Doesn't matter how new the model was. So what happens is David used to live in Philistia for like a year and a half. I mean, he, by all rights and purpose, became a Philistine. He was even going to go to war against Israel at one point. And I think that he just kind of took their customs or something, you know, grabbed the, hey, there's a new cart, we're going to build a new one for the glory of the Lord, throw the ark on there, and we're going to go down the road, and everything's going to be wonderful. But they didn't follow any of the instructions of the Lord. In Numbers chapter 4 and verse 15, it says, "And when Aaron and his sons have finished covering the sanctuary and all the furnishings of the sanctuary, as the camp set out after the sons of Kohath shall come to carry these, but they must not touch the holy things lest they die." And in 17, it says, "Let not the tribe of the clans of the Kohathites be destroyed from among the Levites, but deal thus with them, that they may live and not die when they come near the holy things. Aaron and his sons shall go in and appoint them each to his task and to his burden, but they shall not go in and into look on the holy things, even for a moment, lest they die." God is actually really concerned about life here. He's not sitting back, you know, we're not dealing with an angry God that's just waiting for Uzzah to touch that cart. Man, I know he's going to do it. I'm going to get to zap him down. And this is not the God that we're talking about. God actually showed an exorbitant amount of mercy through this whole situation. They never covered it. They put it on an ark. The Levites weren't carrying it on their shoulders. And he overlooked all that. And it wasn't until they just, you know, absolutely obliterated everything that God had just said before God's anger was kindled. God's mercy and patience was exemplified tremendously in this situation, I believe. He didn't want anybody to die. And so the thing is, none of this would have happened if they would have done everything the right way. If this thing was being carried on poles by Levites, it wouldn't have hit a pothole in the interstate, and it wouldn't have tumbled over. And also, if it would have been covered, no human hand could have touched it. Even if Uzzah would have reached out and grabbed the thing, it would have been touching a blue cloth. So nobody would have died. God actually went through great lengths to try and keep people from dying. But you know what? Whenever we go that far against God's instructions, things are going to happen to us. It's just inevitable. But God's grace is awesome, and we're going to get to see more of that throughout the story here. And the other thing is, it wasn't God's doing in this whole thing. This was the Israelis doing. It was their own responsibility. And honestly, it was David's responsibility. I mean, it was his idea to go and do this thing, and he's the king of the Israelites now. And the responsibility actually falls squarely on his shoulders. And, you know, I know that David's heart was in the right spot. I don't think that he was trying to do this out of pride or arrogance or trying to pull a Saul and try and get the ark to Jerusalem for good luck or whatever. But, you know, heavy is the head that wears the crown, and there's just no way around that. So, reading this story, though, I was a little curious, and I thought to myself, how come no one remembered 40 years prior to this? I mean, it seems like somebody would have been in Kiriath-Jearim that saw 70 men die whenever they looked in the thing. I mean, I could see like one old man's hand kind of raising up above the heads of everybody else. I remember the last time that we did this, and it didn't turn out so well. But we don't hear about that. You know, we don't hear about anybody remembering. Nobody says, hey, I recall in Numbers where we're supposed to handle this ark in a certain manner or fashion. But again, I cannot get too mad at him, because I cannot tell you how many times God has given me instructions and just hours later I forget. and I just do the exact opposite of what he says to do. And I think it's really, more than anything, a testament to show how complacent we can get. You know, I mean, you guys know I'm all about grace and love, and I don't, you know, deal with this kind of stuff so well. This isn't my favorite verse in the Bible, but I'm really happy to be teaching on it tonight. But, you know, we can really get lackadaisical in our Christianity sometimes. You guys are good Christians, but I get lackadaisical in my Christianity sometimes. And take for granted the fact that God doesn't come down and strike me, and, you know, although he has every right to do it. But, you know, through all this, it shows how vitally important it is to seek the Lord in our decisions. Even whenever we're thinking that we're doing the right thing, so often, I mean, we don't know what to do, and I get that, but we can move in a direction and just seek the Lord in it. You know, get into the Word. Obviously, in this situation, if they would have gotten to the Word, it would have helped them tremendously. I mean, they could go back just a few chapters, and it's labeled right there for them. But, you know, it reminds me whenever I first come to know Jesus, I was pretty excited. Things had changed my life a lot. I definitely turned into a new person. So what was happening is at the time I would give away all of my time and money. I would go and help people. I was here every time that the lights were on. I would go to every small group, anybody that needed help or asked for help. I would just go and do it without even thinking about it. I was giving money away that I didn't have, and never really sought the Lord in it. I mean, I was just wanting to do the right thing. And I don't know if it was because I was so bad before. I don't know what the deal was, but I didn't really seek the Lord. I mean, I was reading his word and stuff, but I was just, hey, there's something, I'm going to go and do this and it's good for the Lord and yay. But I actually killed myself doing it. I ran myself into the ground. And not only that, the real sin in the whole matter was I just completely neglected my family. They were supposed to have a lot of that time. They're my first ministry. They were supposed to have that money. You know, bills weren't supposed to be getting behind because I was given to somebody that, you know, I didn't know what they were doing with it. And it's just, you know, that's a perfect example of how just seeking the Lord, taking 5 seconds out of a decision and praying about it and going into the Word and trying to find out what God has to say about it can really alter a lot of things. I mean, they actually could have got the ark all the way to Jerusalem this day. With just a pause, you know? And I know we get excited. I get excited. But anyway. So, all right, the next couple verses are probably the reason why I like the Old Testament so much, why it excites me so much. In verse number 11, it says, "And David was angry because the Lord had broken out against Uzzah." All right, so the reason why I like the Old Testament is that it is raw honesty. It's brutal honesty. You do not have to wonder about, like, how people are feeling or if they messed up. It tells you. I mean, it's clear whether people cross the line or not. And here is one of those times where you would think that a line has been crossed. I mean, it says that David was angry. And it seems like he's angry at God. I mean, it says that he was angry because God, the Lord had broken out against Uzzah. It doesn't say that he was mad at himself for not going back into the Word or not seeking the priest's advice or anything. It sounds like he's mad at God. And it's these kind of verses that actually give me a great deal of comfort, a tremendous amount of comfort in my own Christianity. Because I can't tell you how many times in my life that I've been mad at life or mad at God because things did not go my way. And what these kind of verses scream to me is that it's okay to have emotions. It's okay to have feelings about things and to be upset because God is big enough to handle those type of things. He's big enough to handle me being mad at something, and he can go on and teach me and still move me on to the next level. I mean, David could have been wiped out at this point. I mean, he's mad at God. God says, nope, next king in line. Thank you very much. But God doesn't do that. David goes on to become a wonderful king of Israel. In fact, the greatest king that Israel ever knew. This is the golden age of Israel coming up in the next 40 years. And God blesses this man who gets, from what I can tell, angry at him. So with David being mad, that's okay to get that way. But it's not okay to stay there. God didn't, I mean, David wasn't angry, it doesn't say for long. And in fact, he's not lashing out. He's not screaming. He's not breaking the cart apart more. You know, he's not yelling at Uzzah and Ahio for running over the pothole. You know, he stays calm and collected. He has a sense of self-control with the whole thing. And so we're definitely not supposed to stay there. It's a temporary response. And because God is big enough to deal with our emotions and to deal with us being angry, I think it's worth noting and just stopping that God is big. And we need to remember that God is holy and he is big. He has certain ways that he wants us to do things, certain instructions that he's given us. And we would do well to be mindful of that. You know, the relationship that we have with the Lord is not a cheap relationship. It cost him everything. It didn't cost us anything, but it cost him everything. And we could do well to be mindful of the fact that he is a big God and that he can obliterate us at any moment. And it's his love that holds back his strength. And I just find that pretty remarkable. To remember, you know, so often I sit there and, you know, I always think of God as a graceful and loving God and a forgiving God and thank you, Jesus, that you are. But, I mean, he is Jesus. He is the almighty king of everything. And he shows an exorbitant amount of grace and mercy with us. And I think that that's awesome. So, okay, moving on. It says that that David realizes, you know, what's happened here. And he sees that this is way above his pay grade. He has the idea of sending it over to a Levite, and he says, okay, Obed-Edom, can I put this in your house for a little while? Because it's not doing so well for me right now. And Obed-Edom ends up, it turns out that he actually is of the line of the Levites. I did some studying, and it, from everything I can tell, he comes from the Kohathites. So I think it shows God's provision in the thing. Because God didn't leave his ark to just sit there out in the field of Chidon and, you know, be raided or whatever. You know, he gives David an opportunity to put it into the hands of the right person. And David does that. David moves it over to Obed-Edom's house. An interesting thing about Obed-Edom, he's going to be coming up in verses throughout the rest of Chronicles almost. And he goes on to do some pretty remarkable things. And I love that God is big enough to take mistakes, to take Saul's recklessness with the ark and the thievery of the ark over to another country, into an enemy country, and then back into the hands of the Israelites, you know, into the hands of David that didn't do the right thing and still put it into the right hands. And Obed-Edom is actually going to end up being the vehicle for which the ark gets back to Jerusalem later on. But Janelle and other people are going to be teaching on that later on. So I'll let them tell you about it. But I just think it's cool about God's provision. And because I love David's humble heart here too, because at this moment, because he does realize that it's above his pay grade, it shows a big difference between him and his predecessor Saul. Because I really do think that Saul would have died trying to get this thing back to Jerusalem. I think that he would have just grabbed one Israeli after the other until they were all dead and just a mile at a time until he finally got the thing back to Jerusalem. And, you know, he would have muscled his way through it. But David has a humble heart. He has a heart after God's own heart. And I like that he's aware and is able to humble himself, because David had full intentions of getting this thing back to the city of David. He says, how can I bring the ark of God home to me? And he's not trying to conjure a way of figuring out how to get the ark back. He's just saying, this ain't going to happen right now. So, and then it says, David did not take the ark home into the city of David, but took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom. David had full intentions of bringing this thing to the city of David. And I know that in my life, I have had intentions. I have, things seemed concrete, ready to go, and then they just turn into dust. This last trip over to Haiti, whenever Kim and Cole went over to Haiti, I had full intentions of going. I wanted to. I've been to Africa. I've been wanting to go to Haiti for well over 12 years now. I'm waiting for the time to go. And I know that I'm going to end up there one day. And it's one of those things where it's a timing issue. God's got to get my heart right, I guess, before I head. But I had full intentions of going. Everything was looking like it was going to go. And I was praying about it, and every door shut. You know, it vanished apart right inside of my hands. And then, you know, they get back and they're telling me about these miracles where all these beads showed up and they were able to provide for every kid there. And, you know, there was supposed to be 50 people and then 400 showed up. And, you know, Kim was able to, you know, take medical care over like 200 something people in one day. And it's just like, man, I really wanted to go there, but I got disappointed that I couldn't go. But David handles it properly, you know. I mean, he gets disappointed, but he's doing the right thing. You know, he's not trying to force his own agenda. He submits to the Lord. And in doing so, and I think that this serves for God's sovereignty, he becomes a huge blessing for a family. Because if David would have forced his way all the way to Jerusalem, Obed-Edom would have never got this thing. And it says that God blessed Obed-Edom and his family and everything that he had, his whole household, for about 3 months. And, you know, I just think that that's a real testament to God's sovereignty and how even bad things can turn good because of the Lord. He's just able to do those type of things. So we're going to move on to chapter 14 now. All right, it says, and where am I going through? 12. And it says, and Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David and cedar trees, also masons and carpenters, to build a house for him. And David knew that the Lord had established him king over Israel, and that his kingdom was highly exalted for the sake of his people Israel. And David took more wives in Jerusalem, and David fathered more sons and daughters. And these are the name of the children born to him in Jerusalem: Shammua, Shobab. I remember Rob teaching this in 2 Samuel, and he said, "Side Shobab." Nathan, Shalomon, Ibhar, Elishua, Epele, Noga, Nepheg, Japhia, Elishama, Be'el, Liada, Eliphelet. And when the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over all Israel, all the Philistines went up to search for David. But David heard of it and went out against them. And now the Philistines had come and made a raid in the valley of Rephaim. And David inquired of God. See, he's learning. He inquired of God this time. And it says, "Shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand?" And the Lord said to him, "Go up, and I will give them into your hand." And when they went up to Baal Perazim, and David struck them down there. And David said, "God has broken through my enemies by my hand like a bursting flood. Therefore, let the name of that place is called Baal Perazim." And they left their gods there, and David gave command, and they were burned. So obviously, we see a little bit of maturity here, and that's great. So Hiram, king of Tyre, he starts sending all this stuff over to David. He's like, "I'm going to build you a house, dude. I got carpenters, I got wood, I got masons, and we're going to build you a nice place. You're going to have a pad, and things will be awesome." And I think that it's really cool. David is not only like a great, you know, war leader, you know, military strategist. He's also a good political guy. I mean, he's got a great amount of diplomacy coming along with him. He's already making friends north of him, and they're giving him presents, and, you know, they're recognizing him as king. And I think that that's really awesome. And it says that David knew that the Lord had established him king over Israel. So him being anointed by Samuel at, you know, 14 years old, killing Goliath, killing a lion, fighting off Saul, having an army behind him, taking Jerusalem, all those things didn't help him to realize that he was established to be king, but a present from another country does. So, I don't know what it is about us as humans. My wife, I'm pretty hard on myself, and I'm like, "Oh man, I've messed up this or messed up that." My wife all the time, "Blake, you know, you're way too hard on yourself. You need to calm down." you know, nobody sees those things. You're making a bigger deal out of it than it is. And I'm like, yeah, whatever, you know. But then somebody that I don't know could say, oh man, you know, you're too hard on yourself. You know what? I really am too hard on myself. You're right. There's something about the, you know, somebody that's not quite so close to us, complimenting us and telling us something that, you know, really sticks into our hearts. Yeah, I mean, he's got loads of people following him at this point. And, you know, this other king, you know, maybe it's a peer. Maybe it's because it's another king like him, you know, is establishing him as king. Anyway, it doesn't matter. He recognizes that he's a king now. He recognizes the position that God's put him in. And it's completely changed his whole demeanor. I mean, he's ready to go and fight Philistines now. I mean, he's looking after all of Israel. He's putting the responsibility on his shoulders. He's seeking after the Lord before he goes off to war. I mean, that's the cool thing. A foundation, a house that this king gives him changes everything about him. He changes his identity at this point. And that goes to show that Jesus being the rock of our salvation, that being our foundation, let that change our lives. Let that be our identity. Let Jesus be the foundation and let, you know, move into the position that God wants us to be. I can only imagine the type of person I would be if I would recognize how God sees me 40 years from now. God had already saw David's entire kingship, saw all the things he would do, and saw the end, and that's how God saw David. God saw David after his accomplishments. David hadn't done any of this stuff yet. God sees me 40 years from now after the things I've done. I can't see it, and God help me to recognize what he has in store for me. And you know, let Jesus be my foundation. I would love to be able to do that. All right, so it says David, this is one of those things. His response to this, to having a house now, is to take on more wives and have more kids. I don't get it. You know, one wife is enough. I mean, she's awesome and wonderful, and I don't need anything else. So, I don't know why he decided to do that. And this is one of those things, you know, God lets it slide in the Old Testament back in the day. It's clearly not what God has for us now. He wants one wife, for us, but anyway. You know, it's just one of those things, another example of God's mercy. So, here's another cool thing. It says that during the battle, David goes up against him, and it says like a bursting flood. You know, I can imagine like a dam breaking and all the water flooding through really quickly. I mean, that's how David's army, it seems to me, took the Philistines. It wasn't even much of a battle, it doesn't seem like. It doesn't seem like the Philistines were able to put up much of a fight. David busts through like a bursting flood. Game over. Let's go home. Oh, they left those gods over there. Burn those things. You know, that is how God deals with us. Once he gives us a new foundation, he eliminates the old life from us. The old gods that are there, he burns away. And we can move on from that. I love that. So then we're going to move on to 13 through the rest of the chapter. It says, and the Philistines yet again made a raid into the valley. So they're not too smart. And when David again inquired of God, I love that. God says to him, you shall not go up after them. Go around and come up against them, opposite of the balsam trees. And when you hear the sound of marching in the top of the balsam trees, then go out to battle, for God has gone out before you to strike down the army of the Philistines. And David did as God commanded, and he struck down the Philistine army from Gibeon to Gezer. And the fame of David went out into all the lands, and the Lord brought the fear of him upon all the nations. That's a pretty cool little ending to a chapter. All right, so the Philistines didn't get the hint the first time. So basically, I'm a Philistine. I just don't get it. You got to beat it into me. They go back again, and they try and fight David again. And David inquires of the Lord yet again. He really learns from his mistakes. We need to learn to do that. I need to learn to do that. I need to learn that whenever things don't go right the first time, inquire of God, let him lead the way from then on. So David is really adamant about seeking the Lord at this point. And I think that's awesome. I love his heart. And let us get there. So, but God tells him, no, don't do it the way that you did last time. It's not going to be just an onslaught the way that it was last time. So they had Urim and I forgot. It's like little lots that they threw back in the day that they would kind of get advice from the Lord. And so it wasn't that. It would be more like a yes, no answer. God, should we go against the Philistines? And they cast these lots and it would show up. You know, the bones would be positioned in such a way where David would know yes or no. It's not that. God is talking to David in some sort of a way. Personally, through a prophet, I mean, you know, we don't get privy to that information. But God is dealing directly with David. And I think that that's cool. So David listens to him, and he goes up against them, and God tells him, whenever you hear marching in the balsam trees, or the mulberry trees, so the tops of them, then go up to battle. Some people say that, you know, God was kind of telling him, whenever you hear the wind blowing in the trees, I don't know, you know, I mean, everybody hears wind blowing in the trees. I like to think of it as like the wings of angels all flapping. I mean, that can sound like an army marching, you know, if you ask me, if there's a bunch of angels up there with their wings flapping and, you know, they're all 10 feet tall with flaming swords and stuff, going before David and slaughtering his enemies before him. That's the way that he goes and takes the Philistines the second time. And what I learned from this is that just because God does something one way one time doesn't mean he's going to do it the same way the next time. And I want him to. I would like for him to give me a little list and say, you know, whenever you're having issues with your kids, you go and you fast for 3 days and then you come back and then your kids are going to love you again. But, you know, God doesn't give us that. He is not going to be shoved into a box. He is a wild and awesome God. He is not going to be struck down by formulas or pinned down by human ideas. And we just need to be flexible and open to what God has going for us. So, anyway, he ran the Philistine army really far away, and then God establishes Israel through King David. Everybody now knows that God of Israel is the most powerful God, and that's a really cool story. So that is about it. I'm going to pray. Jesus, I want to thank you so much for the Old Testament. I want to thank you so much for the story that you began so long ago and that you're keeping us in it even still to this day. Help us to recognize the foundation that you have set for us that has been paved by David and by Elijah and by all the apostles and by you yourself. Help us to stand on that. Help us to stand on the history, the rich history that you've given to us. Help us to recognize our identity and help us to live our lives in such a way that we're serving you and seeking you through your word and through prayer with the decisions we make, even if it feels like we've been there before and that we don't need you. Help us to do that. In your powerful name we pray. Amen. All right, so